This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Michael Vlahos of Johns Hopkins. Immediately to 90 AD, Londinium, by the Thames, with our cup of wine on a Saturday, reflecting on events back into our recent history, the Republic turned into the Empire, and forward into the troubled empire of the next centuries. We're looking forward only a few years right now. Our emperor, the semi-divine Domitian, we know will be assassinated at noontime, says the soothsayer, midday. And he's cautious, never going out before late in the afternoon. However, he has a staff that lies to him, and he doesn't have good timekeeping. And so there's a plot against him by his staff in 96 AD. He's aware of it. He's aware that he has to be careful, but he doesn't know who to trust. The historians, Suetonius and others, claim that Domitian was hated by the Senate. Now, we don't validate this in any way. We're not senatorial class. We're equus class. We do know that the Senate is very powerful, more powerful than the semi-divine emperor right now. But the Praetorian Guard is also said to have been informed that there's an assassination plot. The way they'll do it, of course, is to lie to him what time of day it is. He'll go to his office to sign papers, and an ally will approach saying, I've uncovered a plot. He's feigned an injured arm for several days. In the arm is his knife. He'll take out the knife, and with a great struggle on the floor, because Domitian doesn't give up easily, he's stabbed to death. The body is carried out, and the new emperor is his advisor, Nerva. It doesn't last long. In any event, the important thing here is that we know succession in the Roman Empire is violent. That's what's important here. Germanicus has made it very clear to in our conversation these many months and years that violence is the form of succession. Who is the next emperor? Let's see. In these last days, good evening, Germanicus. In these last days, we've had information from our John and Michael selves 2,000 years hence that violence has been part of the conversation about what the chief of staff of the army chief of joint chairman of the joint chiefs of staff, Mark Milley, may or may not have intended or said or done in the moments before the election of 2020 when the emperor was up for renewal and in the events following the riot at the Capitol the day after that, in fact, January 7th, may have said to our chief rival on planet Earth right now, that would be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the general-in-chief of the Chinese Army. I mention that because some weeks past, you were very careful to say that succession, violent succession, is part of empire. Can we now observe, is it possible to observe that the talk of violence is part of empire? Good evening to you.
Good evening, Gaius. Talk is the predicate to action. And therefore, talk is not obviously the same as action, but it is a tremendously serious marker that we're on the road to action. And so the talk that's been happening has actually included action, but not yet the kind of violent actions that attended the Roman imperial succession. Now, why is empire so violent when it comes to succession? And this is the problem of establishing legitimacy. A republic, by definition, has developed a constitutional framework, the res publica, that is consensual, participatory, and that people look forward to as a kind of glory of the republic in that it indicates unity and strength of purpose. And republics, when they collapse, do so in large part because they lose the consensual aspect and the nature of relationships that had agreed to that certain constitutional form of res publica. Those relationships have altered. And of course, for Rome, that was very clearly the decline of citizenship and participation and the rise of the enormously powerful Roman elite, the optimates, that were able to effectively seize power themselves. And what Augustus did was to preside over a replacement, or ersatz, as the Germans would say, form of constitutional order. And that form was not wholly real. And therefore, while it lasted for a couple generations, using the strength of authority that adhered to the Julio-Claudian family, that broke down relatively quickly with the end of Tiberius and the
Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and then the Nero was the end of the Julians at the end.
And then the succeeding dynasty of Vespasian and Titus, and of course Domitian at the end. Right. That was also short-lived and not very successful. In terms of kinship, blood kinship.
Violence. Each time, Germanicus, you've established that the only succession that actually worked in the first century that we're living in here in Londinium is violence.
Right, and that is what I fear lies ahead for this country, because the constitutional framing of a republic is dissolving. And the very use of the term of art, our democracy, is a testament to the open-endedness of what lies ahead. Democracy is really a code word for the ritual of voting, not the constitutional, institutional framing that makes everything work and that allows for smooth or at least agreed-upon transitions. It is instead a kind of way of devolving what was a republic into a democracy. Democracy is simply a plebiscitary alternative. So what we're facing is a politics of power struggles between factions, and the factionalization has devolved into a battle between two subcultures, two representations of American identity, and a split within the old American religion. And we see this now. We call it the culture wars, but it's very deep, almost existential. And the battle is going to be fought out in new and different extra constitutional ways. So what we're seeing with the news about Milley's indiscretion, what we're seeing in terms of impeachment after impeachment, what we're seeing with the inflation of the evil that leaders do being blown up to the point where the elected leader becomes equivalent to Herr Hitler, where the crimes are so enormous and so mind-boggling that they threaten the very destruction of America, that they represent pure evil, and will lead to a tyranny worse than any that has walked the earth, is in fact a sign of things coming apart. But it's also a way to excuse and rationalize the ultimate use of violence. What had been a constitutionally elected, within the Republican context, a leader is now evil, then that essentially gives permission to go after him by whatever means are necessary, because the elected leader is a constitutional threat to the survival of America. And that is true from the standpoint of red, as much as it is from the standpoint of blue. Blue is in the saddle right now, and yet it has operated clearly from these revelations about General Milley. It has operated with an eye toward a violent overthrow. It failed with the investigations and the Star Chambers. It failed with the impeachments, but it was ready to go into action through the new Praetorian Guard, which is represented by its own leader, General Milley.
Domitian is assassinated by his staff, despite the fact that he's popular with the army, and he's popular with the people of Rome. He's a strong-minded leader. He rules for 15 years, and yet that is not enough to protect him from the Senate. Nero was, he was said to be a suicide, but he really thought he was going to be killed, which is why he killed himself. He was also an enemy of the Senate, the Optimates, although he also had Praetorian enemies. The year of four emperors in between, to move to the Flavian dynasty, the army was present in each instance as we went through the candidates. The army injecting itself into the election of 2020. I tried to remember Germanicus dating back to General Eisenhower in 48 and 52. The army's been present as well, if you look at it not in terms of historical figures, but the uniform standing there. In 48, MacArthur's standing there. In 52, Eisenhower's elected. In 60, Eisenhower endorses Nixon, but that's not enough for Kennedy to take sway. And there's friction with Eisenhower. You recall that. Eisenhower was not at all pleased with the young president. Then we do have violent succession with the assassination and Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson in 64 introduces the army, the falsehood about the Gulf of Tonkin, introducing the army and the navy and Vietnam into the conversation. In 68, Johnson steps down because the popular rejection of his use of the military. And yet at the same time, we know that Johnson's phone tapped Agnew to find out that Nixon is back channel conveying to Vietnam, don't make a deal. Don't move before I get into office. He's moving around Humphrey. Now I'll stop there. The army, then the military, the sharp end of the sticks have been present for some time, and we haven't noticed it till now.
Well, this is structurally deeply connected to the unraveling of the constitutional order and the problem of legitimacy. An empire, by definition, is engaged in international competition and relies heavily on the military to execute that mission. And the military becomes so central within the executive branch. And here I'm talking about Rome, but just think about the United States. The military is integral to the executive branch in America today. And the military-industrial complex is no laughing matter when it comes to power and leverage in our society, and power and leverage, most critically, with the chief executive himself, and represents a percentage of Americans that's much larger simply than the active duty and much larger simply than the amount of money we spend directly on defense, but altogether comes to about 10% of the country, and it is in a position where it's relied upon to run our international relations. Our entire approach to the world is run through the military at this point. So the military is not only enormously powerful, it is also deeply connected with supporting imperial rule, supporting the president. And therefore, there's a kind of codependency that's developed in which the president, or in the case of our current commander-in-chief, president or emperor-to-be is dependent on the military guaranteeing and securing his position and power.
Do you I recited the American Empire since the Second War. And also in 48, Eisenhower was recruited to run. He chose not to. Nobody knew whether he was a Democrat or Republican in 48. He eventually did run in 52. Do you believe the military, the Pentagon, is aware of its outsized role in what you'd have to say succession battles? Is this something that was thrust upon them, or does the military, the senior staff in Washington, did they embrace this?
Well, it was more than an embrace. The transformation of the American military that occurred in World War II and then was ratified soon after by the emergence of the Cold War has placed the military at the very center of the national identity and America's self-conception. In other words, it is the force that realized American exceptionalism, that realized the God's charge to America, and therefore has a sort of divine element to its charter. And moreover, that once that became our daily approach to ourselves and the world, as the military grew in size during the non-war that was the Cold War, but also not a peace, the military came to depend on working the president and Congress in order to sustain its lifestyle. So a very outsized military subculture, which believes that its mission is divine, and just ask any naval leader or any carrier battle group commander, it oozes from their pores, as it were. They are out there as the only force upholding a stable, free world that is the defender of democracy, et cetera, et cetera. And as a result, this combination of institutionalized messianism with the need to work the emperor so that the lifestyle is sustained creates an irresistible incentive on the part of military leaders to become essentially, if not puppet masters, then so essential to the president that they are, in a sense, in a form of super leverage. I wouldn't call it control, but it is a position that is eerily similar to that of the army in the Roman Empire.
Michael Vlahos, Germanicus. John Batchelor, Gaius, Londinium 90 AD, and at the same time, here we are in the 21st century. This is Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.